KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. One of the great things about doing this show for a little while is you get to have people come back and talk about their work. And I'm sitting across from somebody who I consider to be a kind of friend of the show, the writer-director Paul Weitz. We know from such films as In Good Company, American Dreams, Admission, which she was last year, and Being Flynn, for which is also, last year for that. His newest film as writer-director is Grandma, starring Lily Tomlin. First of all, Paul, thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, man, thanks for having me back from the dead.
We'll see about that. I think one of the things I see in this last few films that you've done, but even goes back to, for me, the adaptations of About a Boy or early stuff, is that there tends to be this sort of division in your films between people who are okay looking for help and people who aren't.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You look at American Dreams or Admission, certainly that idea of people who are okay with the idea of being socially involved.
I mean, it's a lot of the characters have help thrust upon them. I mean, I guess you could even go back to American Pie, speaking of thrusting, and say that those guys, you know, actually were looking for help with the emotional rite of passage of moving on from high school and realizing you're not going to be with your best friends every day for the rest of your life. And that was manifesting itself in extreme discomfort as regards to the opposite sex. And in About a Boy, you know, Hugh Grant's character gets this odd child sort of inserting himself into his life and forcing him to become a human being. And in this most recent film, Grandma, Lily Tomlin's character is at a point in her life where she's somewhat happily, self-protectively isolated and is quite misanthropic. But her granddaughter, who's 18 years old, shows up in need of her help, and it forces her to sort of emerge from her bubble and in a sort of bull in a china shop fashion go out into the world. And she does need help. Lily's character needs help dealing with her own grief in the course of the movie, and finds that in kicking ass for her granddaughter.
Yeah, and attempting to help her daughter, she basically has to admit that she needs help as well. We can say that was kind of the case for Topher Grace's character in Good Company too, couldn't we?
Yeah, no question. I mean, a lot of the movies that I dealt with over the first bunch of years that I've gotten to do this were about mentorship and the idea that, as opposed to your parents, who in general don't want you to experience pain, a mentor can help you through some fairly painful things, and the end result can be growth. So exploring that was something that I've been interested in for a while, and it's been exciting recently to get over whatever mental stumbling block I had and do that in a film most recently involving almost solely female protagonists.
Yeah, I mean, the film was almost entirely populated by women.
Yeah, Sam Elliott has his moment. And my friend Nat Wolf, who's in Paper Towns and I've worked with before, gets to play a complete buffoon who's impregnated Julia Garner's character as the ultimate baby daddy you don't want your daughter to have. So he's not really speaking articulately for the male perspective, but he's certainly occupying a certain a space in the male terrain.
But I just wondered if the idea of setting off a movie almost entirely populated by women, or women having the decision-making power, really, I mean, that's what it comes down to, ultimately, being invested with this power, if that was one of the first things you thought about you'd wanted to do when you were working on Grandma.
Yeah. I oddly enough, there was an initial version of this movie, I think, years ago that would have involved a male protagonist in his 70s, and that didn't take. And then I met Lily through working on Admission, and then I sat down when I was in the throes of the delight of having a movie come out with Admission, which is, for a director, is the point at which you feel the least amount of control in your life. And I was freaking out. And so I sat down to write this thing, and I started hearing Lily's voice as this character, and the thing just kind of wrote itself. And so for whatever reason, a bunch of synapses had flipped. And there was no question that this movie was going to be completely populated by women in all the active roles. And also that it wasn't a conscious decision on my part, honestly, which is, I think, a good thing. It was just that's who the characters were. And I'm not totally sure where it came from.
Because I was just wondering, because it's interesting, there's this idea of what parenthood means. And for Lily's character and for her daughter, played by Marcia Gay Harden, parenthood is almost this abstraction.
Yeah.
Where if you apply a certain kind of discipline technique, it should turn out the way it should turn out.
I mean, it's interesting. There is a generation skipping in here where Julia's character is terrified of asking her mother for money because her mother is a hardcore butt-kicking corporate lawyer.
And it's become
that seemingly in reaction to Lily's character, who is a very left-leaning
combative, intellectual, feminist poet.
And there's a line in the movie where when they finally are going to see the mother, Marcia Gay Harden, Lily says, "I'm scared," and the granddaughter can't believe she's scared, and Lily says, "I've been scared of your mom since she was 5 years old," which I do think happens sometimes if you have a child who's particularly focused. You're slightly intimidated.
It's funny, too, because I just saw in some ways that the three generations of women this family we get is the Julia's character almost seems to be soft as kind of a revolt to both her mother and her grandmother.
Yeah, her mother and her grandmother are both women who suck the air out of the room. And Julia's character is at sea a little bit. She's sort of just forming. And I think she's dealing with questions of whether... of self-worth, essentially. And, you know, there's a scene where Lily's character is trading insults with her girlfriend, who she's just broken up with, who's played by Judy Greer. And they're extremely esoteric insults. Like, one of them calls the other an ingenue, another says writer in residence, solipsist. And then afterwards in the car, Julia says to Lily, "You know, my friends just call each other bitch, hoe, and slut." And Lily's reaction is, "I don't want to ever hear you say that word again about, you know, slut." And there is so much to be gained, I think, by Julia's character from Lily's character. And you can also see that, look, it's almost impossible at a certain age to learn from your parents, because in order to grow, you have to reject them. So I think that's what's happened to a degree.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to probably the only filmmaker who's sort of connected the feminine mystique to the X-Men, Paul Weitz, whose newest movie is director or writer, is Grandma. As that kind of wordplay, though, that sort of high culture, low culture stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point in the movie where Lily is giving Julia's hard time, Julia's character a hard time, because Julia doesn't know what the feminine mystique is. And Julia turns it on her and says, "Well, you don't know that Mystique is a character in X-Men." I do think that, like, within a very short period of time, there's been an erasure of women's history in terms of in the minds of younger people, which is why I think it's really important that there's sort of a after sort of the idea of calling oneself a feminist became a little bit of a gauche thing to do. God, that's a pretentious way of putting it. I think people didn't want to be considered feminists, and now that word needs to be brought back into the fold, and some young people are doing that. But that was one really exciting thing about having Lily's character and Lily to play it and inform me and help me as I was writing this, was that she's been a part of this rapid progression and sometimes regression of women's history in America.
I guess, though, for me, Lily falls into a tradition of characters going, if you want to go back to American Pie, Stifler or Chess Parliamentarian, Down to Earth, and he's laughing across from me now.
Well, I love the connection of Lily's hardcore feminist poet with Stifler and American Pie, which actually, yeah, there is some connection there. They say things which other people only think, and they don't give a damn what the results are, and that's what sort of the charm of them is.
But that kind of character, who's kind of elbows first, goes through a lot of things you worked on, again, Down to Earth or About a Boy or any of the films you've done, that kind of person is a character. And the idea of taking what can be archetypal and just comic relief and trying to make a character out of it must be part of the challenge for you and part of the interest for you.
Yeah, well, it's certainly fun to have them in scenes and to see characters bounce off them. I mean, you know, Lily's character, when I first gave her the script, she said, "Gosh, she's really angry and kind of, you know, doesn't give a damn what people say, and I'm not sure I understand where these various things are coming from." So then I went through it with her, and at the end, once she's expended all this energy, there, I think, is kind of a moment of grace for her, where she actually has gotten through and helped her granddaughter, and in doing that is brought to a level where she no longer has rage with which to deal with her own sadness and the beauty of having lost her long-term partner, which is what's happened to her.
Yeah, because one of the things that I think kind of happens fairly often, what you do too, is the idea of a moment, a really big impact, and sort of dealing with the aftermath of that and the kind of people forestalling grief.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, growing up, my brother and I, our dad was this almost like biblical figure. He was an extremely charming, extremely masculine German Jew who had ended up joining the American Army after during World War II. And every day while dealing with, he was a fashion designer and lived high on the hog and had a kind of marvelous time, but at the same time was deeply haunted by his own childhood and this feeling that he doesn't fit in. And I think we could see every day the example of somebody who was trying to deal with a tremendous amount of rage while not hurting these people around him, you know, these little kids who he was bringing up. And there was something really poignant about that. And that feeling, I think, makes its way into a lot of the characters that I write, whether they be male or female.
Yeah, even I was just having seen a couple of your plays, the idea of trying to push through that, to not acknowledge it, as if somehow velocity relieves you of having to wallow in it or even acknowledge it.
Yeah, I definitely think that at some point everybody in their life feels that they're in extremis. And there's a play I wrote called Trust, done in New York, where Zach Braff played a guy who had sold kind of an idiotic .com called chlorophyll.com and suddenly had $100 million. And because of that, his marriage is falling apart and he's not sure what to do with his life. And he ends up going to a S&M parlor where it turns out the dominatrix, coincidentally, is somebody he went to high school with. But anyway, this idea that how did I get here how do I get out of here is a little bit at play in some of the characters I do.
But this is kind of interesting, too, because I'm guessing it's one of the perquisites or one of the disadvantages of doing a film for a very low budget. It all takes place in a pretty circumscribed time period.
Yeah, that was an advantage here. I really felt that I wanted something where I had enough control. To me, getting control as a filmmaker is all about being able to give over as much control as you want to the actors and to the story, so that you're not trying to please anybody except the story and the characters and the actor. This is a perfect movie to do with a very low budget because it was about two people who were broke, who are just at this particular moment in their life. It would be different 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, have no money and no credit card. Lily has just paid off all these bills and has cut up her credit card to prove a point to herself. And the granddaughter, Julia, has crashed her mother's car in the garage, like hit the gas instead of the brake. And her mom has confiscated her credit card. So the two of them need dough. So, and over the course of the day, they're trying to get it.
You say this movie takes place over the course of a day.
Yeah. And so given that, it was a perfect movie to do with no budget. And there was never any moment where I felt pressed, actually. I had enough time with Lily to go through every beat of the script and to have her give me cool ideas for it. Like, for instance, there's a scene where somebody gets slugged by a little girl, and this is something that she had observed happen in Las Vegas. She was there with her now wife, Jane Wagner, who's a wonderful writer. But anyway, there was a little girl wandering around in the street alone, and apparently Jane went over to her and said, "Darling, where's your parents?" And the little girl slugged her. She clearly had been told not to talk to strangers in an extreme way. So I pirated that for a certain part of the movie.
Do you feel like you were probably doing this to give yourself problems to solve that you hadn't really had to deal with yet? I mean, because it's I can't think of another film that was dealt in such a contained period. And clearly that's part of dealing with a low budget, but also that becomes a different kind of setting to work with that you hadn't really done before.
Storytelling-wise, I felt that I have had a bit of a flaw in trying to tell too many stories at the same time and trying to bite off too much. My eyes are too big for my stomach thematically. I mean, I would say that in terms of just my work on Admission, I really like that film and love the work that the actors did in it, but I feel like I, as a filmmaker, was trying to do too many things at the same time. And in this case, I felt that if I simplified and streamlined the story, in theory, that would allow the themes and the characters to get much more complex because I was trying to, there's less wasted energy and effort. I also saw a film which I would recommend anyone called Oslo, August 30th. I hope it's 30th as opposed to 31st, which is basically following over the course of a day and a half in the life of an addict as he gets out of treatment and goes in to try to get a job for when he's going to leave treatment. It's a Norwegian film. It's a really amazing film, utterly different from this, but
has the same kind of simplicity to it.
Yeah, same simplicity and same what the hell's going to happen at the end of it feeling.
We'll take a break since we're talking about treatment. It's The Treatment. My guest is Paul Weitz, whose newest film is writer-director is Grandma. There's more to come. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. The fellow sitting across from me swallowing is Paul White. He just had a little water during the break. We're talking about his new film, Grandma.
It's vodka, Elvis.
Hope you brought enough for everybody. One of the things I was thinking about, though, when I was watching the film for the first time is that they start off, these two characters, Julia and Lily, almost as if they're the same age. This childish gesture, actually, of cutting up all her credit cards. She's looking for cookies so they can sit outside and have cookies. It's really kind of like watching two kids almost. And then it kind of becomes about Elle, Lily's character, having to sort of deal with maturity as much as her granddaughter.
Yeah, especially if you define maturity as the need to take care of and care about somebody else. She is thrust into the... You get the feeling that this is not a granddaughter who comes to hang out with her grandmother that much. It's just she needs money.
or her mother, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. And they are both selfish at the beginning of the movie. And each of them becomes thawed towards each other during the course of it.
I guess I was thinking about that, too, because there's so much, and we've talked about this a bit before, there's so much about loneliness and finding comedy and loneliness in your work.
Yeah, I mean, certainly like Hugh Grant's character in About a Boy, which I did with my brother, the whole movie was essentially about depression and how people deal with it, and that is, loneliness often comes from somebody telling you you're not particularly, you're not worth anything at some point in your life. And also that rings a bell, I think, for anybody with any brains. You know you're not worth all that much. And Elle's character has been abandoned by her long-term love, who's passed away before her, and also at one point was a well-known writer, but now is not. And also, no doubt, has suffered discrimination because she's lesbian and has certain views and is sort of railing against this and has her fist up in the air.
Because just that kind of that loneliness of these three generations of women, and they've all, at least the mother and the grandmother, made these choices, and it's up to Julia now to decide what she wants to do. And seeing these examples, I just again find myself thinking about, you just mentioned About a Boy, but I think this is something that kind of runs through. We could say, again, Topher Grace, or we could say certainly Tina Fey's character in Admission. I mean, that idea of somebody being lonely, I mean, that and finding some comedy in that is a recurrent thing for you to do.
Look, there's a darn good reason. There's a great appeal to being alone, frankly. You're not at the mercy of other people, and your emotions aren't at the mercy of other people. And that's one thing about sort of becoming a parent, I feel, is it's marvelous. And at the same time, it's really awfully painful to care about other people, and especially people who you have control over. This is radio, so you can't tell that I'm cringing and grimacing at what I'm saying.
Yeah, my guest, who has a lot to explain when he gets home, is Paul White. His newest film is writer-director is Grandma. You're talking about points of comparison, and two things I find myself thinking about was, first of all, Paul Mazursky's Harry and Tonto.
Oh, cool. Yeah, Mazursky, who is a wildly overlooked filmmaker who died this last year, was amazing at finding a overlap between stories that are about our society and stories that are utterly personal, which is kind of the sweet spot that I like to try to get into, where you're just following these characters and at the same time there's implications about where America is at. And Harry and Tonto, yeah, the Art Carney character is alone and lonely. And I guess I can even go back to like reading John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, and this idea of like, there is a little of that in Elle hanging around with her granddaughter, who's incredibly callow. But at the same time, you know, Lily's character is also for the first time getting to talk about her most recent girlfriend and how good the sex was and how that started her writing again for the first time in 20 years. So it's also one thing that I tried to keep an eye on was that just hanging out with each other is actually a joyful thing in the middle of all this stress for these two people.
Yeah, because finally they do know that one way or another they have to be able to depend on each other.
Yes, and that's, I guess, the joy of it.
I guess I was thinking, too, also about Lily's first film, Robert Altman's Nashville, because there are a lot of characters in that, and there are a lot of characters in this. I mean, they swim through a bunch of different ponds, if you will, and one of my favorite scenes in any of your movies happens to be in this film where L goes to visit a friend to get money, this transsexual tattoo artist.
Played by Laverne Cox, yeah.
Yes.
And that was, for me, important in here because it is somebody who's a friend and who, at some point, Lily loaned her some dough because she had some... I met somebody who this had happened to. She had some defective silicon in her body that was leaking into her knees. I don't know why I'm depicting this film as if it's...
we should say, by the way, the film is a comedy.
Yeah,
I keep going back to that.
If that's not funny, what is? I liked the idea of showing somebody who just loves Lily's character. And she's a tattoo artist, but Lily's long-term love in the movie was an artist. And so we sort of developed a backstory, Laverne and I, that... that this had been her sort of art teacher and that she'd gotten to know the two of them. And there's love between them because Lily's character is very combative in the movie and it was really nice to have her a real friend. And Lily, I think, was a big fan of Laverne's, both as an actress and as a political figure. So it was really nice also to be using Lily's actual feelings towards certain of the actors, whether it be Laverne Cox or Marcia Gay Harden, who was, I think, the only, in the movie, that character needs to be intimidating to Lily's character. And I think that in a little way, Lily was really admiring of Marcia Gay as an actress and was like, oh gosh, do you think she'd really do this? And slightly intimidated, I would say. And I wouldn't say that Lily's probably intimidated. You could probably, by very many people.
Because I guess, as I was thinking, watching that scene, when that tattoo part starts off, we see a guy tattooing. So we think that she's going to see him.
Oh, yeah.
So it's sort of, the movie is kind of about starting with offering one possible idea and ending up with it being something else,
mm-hmm.
which is also a kind of a big tenet of comedy too, isn't it? Just sort of flipping things around.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly nice when, one thing you learn when, certainly I did not do this, you do a research screening for a movie, like a studio movie. You learn that you're in the catch 22 of the audience has certain expectations and they also want to kill you if they know what's happening next. So that's where I think as a writer director, the whole trick is to give the ball to the characters and have them doing things which you're not expecting. And as a director, one of the reasons I like directing my own writing is because I have full license to say to an actor, okay, just change the line, you know, make it sound like how you want it to sound, which is a big weapon in the arsenal of freshness. And I get very upset actually if things are being done in exactly the way that I want them to. Like there's a scene in the movie between Lily Tomlin and Sam Elliott, which went in a completely different direction and got way more explosive and raw than I thought it was going to get.
Really? How was it written?
The words were the same, but when we read through it, it was kind of more contained. And then when they started to do it, they were really getting at each other. It starts out as a very sort of comedic and warm scene between two people who have a past, and then that past sort of becomes a landmine, which they both step on during the course of the scene. But that's particularly exciting to me as a director. And I can remember after doing it a couple of times, I had a note for Sam and he came over and he's like, all right, I know you want me to pull it back a little bit. And I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, go with your instinct, because that would have been imbecilic to then say, yeah, pull it back. But that's the great joy, is being the first audience to something when you're a director.
So this one of the reasons you did an independent film too, because you want to sort of step away from that process of, I mean, you want to have the kind of control you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fairly guilt-racked person and very, very conscious of when somebody's giving me dough to do a movie. And also, honestly, like you're in some ways, I think any artist is always dealing with the audience being their collaborator for better and worse. And there's one perspective, which is everything is for the audience. There's another perspective, which is that if you're thinking about some abstract audience while you're making something, it's not going to please any particular person to the extent that you could if you were just listening to the piece. So, I don't know. In this case, honestly, the person I really wanted to please was Lily Tomlin, because it's almost everything in this, even though I wrote it, she knows more about than I do.
We should talk a little bit about the film playing Sundance, which is where it had its premiere, and you hadn't been there for...
No, I hadn't been there since being an actor in Chuck and Buck, which was a completely surreal circumstance.
Yeah, 15 years earlier.
Yeah. when I made the film, I didn't really have any particular result in mind beyond that I felt that I was in some slight degree of trouble with myself.
By what you mean?
I mean, I felt like I was letting myself down on some level, as in terms of me deploying whatever skill that I have as a storyteller. And in this case, so I just didn't think. I just wrote the thing. And then I remember saying to the nice gentleman who financed it, I was like, we better do this fast before I change my mind. Then I wasn't really thinking about what was going to happen when I finished it. But the sort of fantasy scenario, if I'd allowed myself to go there, would be that it would premiere at Sundance, and that it would, it ended up being the closing night film there. And I had this naive idea that it was going to be just sort of this, just a bunch of other filmmakers chatting about their films and stuff. I'd forgotten that it had not been yet picked up for distribution, so there were some stakes involved. I ended up with Sony Classics. And the result is it's going to be in movie theaters, which is really exciting. But it may not get any more exciting than seeing it for the first time in that big audience at Sundance.
Yeah, because the idea for you of you kind of graduated pretty early on to doing big studio films.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, American Pie, was not meant to be a big studio film. And the first one that my brother and I wrote was called Ants, which was an odd animated film starring Woody Allen.
And Sylvester Stallone.
And Sylvester Stallone and Meryl Streep and Gene Hackman. It was before people realized that Hollywood films were almost exclusively going to be animated within 10 years. So everybody was like, I want to make a film that my grandkids can see someday. So everybody signed on to do this one. And I remember on the first day that it opened, driving by a movie theater where it was playing, and there was a small child jumping up and down, pointing at the poster and going, ants, ants, ants. And I was like, oh my God, this is a children's film. I completely forgot. So I think this thing of forgetting the audience, sadly, has been a part of my DNA for a while. And American Pie was not meant to be some sort of studio behemoth. And then we did a test screening, which went in such a good fashion that it ruined test screenings for the rest of my life. And suddenly the studio was like, we're going to put that out in a month. And then there was a gigantic turnover in the executive body of the studio, and they decided to wait a few months before putting it out.
But this film, having this film play in a way that's different from the entirety of your career to this point.
I tell you, one weird thing is that there are certain times when I'm watching it in a real audience where I feel like it plays closer to American Pie than any film I've done, just because Lily's character is funny. I do think that in this film, there's less wasted effort on my part, and there's something purer about it.
Do you think you might want to go back and do this again, to work outside of this sort of the comforts?
But I'm not sure I have any options. Sorry. I'm cursed with, I love sort of studio films of the golden era of studio filmmaking, like Preston Sturges and Billy Wilder, and before that, Ernst Lubitsch. And I also really love independent cinema, contemporary independent cinema. So I like both things, and I'd like to be able to do both if possible.
I'm sure you'll be doing one or the other when you come back. I can't thank you enough for doing this again, Paul. Really, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, the editor of this show is the associate producer, Blake Veit. The show is recorded and mixed by J.C. Swadek. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.